Okay, looks like it's about time for us to get started. All right, thank you all for coming. My name is Matthias Wolnick. I'm a program manager in the file server team, and I'm going to try and give you a whole bunch of technical information and more insight into how dynamic access control works. And we'll make this a little bit more freeform. I have lots of content, but if there are specific areas which we want to go into, we can do that and we can alter based on what we need. So let's start with one really basic, simple question, first of all. Who here was just at my overview talk a moment ago? Oh, interesting. Not nearly everybody. Good. That means we're going to get a little bit of overview first. We're going to give a little bit of a high-level view before we get into all the meaty pieces. We're going to make sure everybody has a level set of where what we're talking about. Good. So then the first session of objective stands. Quick introduction to dynamic access control. What is it? How does it work? And then we're going to go into some of the details, some of the weirdness, some of the how does this thing actually work? Why does it do it like that? And actually, the last one, we're not going to talk about too much. That's okay. All right, so dynamic access control. There's four big areas that we're going to talk about. That is classification. We always, when we talk about dynamic access control, we talk about compliance and data governance. One of the basic questions that always comes up is, how do I tell which files are important and which ones are not? Which files must not leave the organization? Which files has to be retained for X amount of times? Which ones must not be deleted? All those kind of questions come up. And for all of them, we need to decide at some point, how do we describe that data? And how do we make sure that description is accurate over time? Then there's a piece that we talk about, which is expression-based auditing. How do we audit effectively? How do we make sure that audit data that we collect about file accesses and file modifications is useful rather than just plentiful? Expression-based access conditions. We're going to spend a whole bunch of time on that one specifically, so I'm not going to go into too much detail right now because we'll be right back there in a moment. And lastly, encryption. Encryption really talks about the question of what happens once my file leaves the protections that I can enforce on corporate hardware. What happens when that file gets sent out via email, when a file gets moved out of the organization completely? So let's jump right into expression-based access policy. What is it? Why is it important? Well, one of the basic problems that we have with expression, with ACLs, as it is today, is they are somewhat rigid. We can easily say, you know, this group must have access to a share or a file. That's easy enough. But it's also very inflexible. How many people still have access to files, are part of groups that they were part of more than 5 years ago? Anybody? Anybody still have a member of a group 5 years ago that shouldn't be on anymore? Yeah? Yeah, it's normal, right? We don't always know. We know exactly when somebody moves from one section, from one team to another, but we don't always know which groups they need to be on when they do so. Or which ones they no longer need to be on. It's a problem. We need to be a little bit more flexible around that. Now, what we did is we created a concept that we said, let's make sure that ACLs, ACEs effectively, can be based on an expression rather than just a statement of a single group membership. So in addition to being able to say, you are a member of this group, we should be able to say, you're a member of this group and that group, or a member of this group and that group, or a third group. Then when we said that, we realized, well, if we know something about files, which we do, we know something about the files because of classification. We introduced the file classification infrastructure in 2008 R2 to identify important information, to label files. We know something about users. We do. We have Active Directory. Active Directory has all kinds of good information about users. And it's useful data, ones that we know is being subjected to process. When you move from team to team, things in Active Directory get updated. This is useful for us. We could base things on that. And we know things about machines. We know when you're using a corporate machine. We also know when you're not using a corporate machine. We can tell these kind of things. If we can use all that information inside an access expression to evaluate access, we can make much more effective access controls. For example, in this case, we could say, well, you have access to files as long as you're in the same department as the file and as long as you're actually using a corporate managed machine. If you're using your own personal laptop that you brought from home, yeah, you just don't have access to these files. You shouldn't have access to these files. Now, what are the real building blocks to make dynamic access control work? There's a few of them. User claims, device claims. And this is actually something that we will dig into quite a bit in a bit here. And they're basically there to describe users, they're to describe machines, and there's something that's fundamentally part of the Active Directory system. They're there so that we can make access decisions around them. Expression-based ACEs. ACL is always a collection of ACEs, and it's one of the basic problems that we have is that in an existing ACL system, individual ACEs are ORed. With the new system, we allow AND operations to happen, and suddenly things become much more flexible that we never had an opportunity before. Classification. We'll talk about all the things that are new in classification. There is a bunch of information out there already about what was new, what was in classification in 2008 R2, and I won't go into too much detail on that. I'll tell you all the things that were done that's new and how they were done and why they were done and things like that. Then we have central access and audit policies that, so that we can define our policies in the central location by somebody who has a knowledge of what they're doing. Instead of asking every file server admin out there to become educated in what his corporate governance requirements actually mean and what will happen if he doesn't follow them correctly and, you know, try to make our file server admin liable for something silly that he does not understand at all. And there's access denied assistance. Basic problem, you don't have access to a file on the server. Now what? How do I get access? How do I manage that system? SharePoint has a very nice workflow system, but file server and traditionally didn't. We just didn't. We had a dialog box that said, access denied. Go contact your admin. There is a lot of infrastructure that we added into the access denied assistance to make this better. But I'll forewarn you now, I'm not going to spend any time talking about access denied assistance at this point. If you really want to, we can, but I'm not currently planning on doing so. I spent some time in the overview to talk about it, but we can, if we have time, we can always go into it. All right, user and device claims. If we think back to before 2012, we can make access decisions based on group policy, based on groups. This is good, but it's also a little complicated. As a result, you have such fun things as extra groups generated just so we can restrict access a little bit more. So you have your project alpha group. But then you need a subgroup underneath that just so you can restrict some specific members to have access to a subset of files of project alpha, the sensitive data, or the ones about the potential acquisition of this other technology from another company, which the rest of the project alpha team does not need to know about, et cetera, et cetera. So we end up building these extra groups, these shadow groups, just to, well, limit things a little bit further and a little bit further, and we end up with a massive explosion of groups. To make matters worse, groups aren't really that flexible. We have a whole bunch of restrictions on them, right? We have security groups, we have, what are the other ones? So we have universal groups, et cetera. They cause some problems. And once you start talking about domains and forests, et cetera, things get even more complicated. So we end up with some problems. Now, in the last, well, at least, of course, groups tells us nothing about machines. Nothing at all. You can't tell if the group that you're part of is also currently logged into your own personal laptop or your phone or your iPad or whatever else it may be. That's not a good thing. Right? If we don't have any control over those other environments as a corporation, if they're not part of the corporation, this is a problem. Should we allow access? In some cases, it's fine. Others, it's not. But we have no way of dealing with that before 2012. Now, what we can do now is we actually made, in 2012, we made a series of bigger changes. One of the most basic ones is our Kerberos tokens, which used to always contain group SIDs for the individual user, now also contain claims. We now issue claims for the user and for the device that they're using as part of the Kerberos token. Those claims can be used to make access decisions on file servers. File servers being the first workload that actually takes advantage of the claims that are in the Kerberos token as of Windows Server 2012. Claims, on the other hand, of course, are provisioned out or granted out to everybody in the organization as required, and we deal with such things as cross-force translation and trust and all those kind of things, so that we can solve some of the problems that we had with groups. As a result, we can then now generate such nice little things as on here, as we see on there, right? We allow write if you're a member of finance, just like before, but only if you're a full-time employee and if you're using a corporate device. These are the kind of things that we just never were able to do before. Now, expression-based ACEs. Individual ACLs are always made up of a group of ACEs. This doesn't change. Nothing that we did in 2012 around dynamic access control removed functionality that we used to have in the ACL system. We didn't replace anything. What we did is we extended it. In addition to the ORs, the OR relationship between the various ACEs, we now allow you to do AND operations. So as a basic system, if you have, as this example says, 500 projects in your organization, for each project, you may have 100 different countries that have to deal with it, and 10 divisions that have to deal with those. To provide the correct level of access control, you need up to approximately 500,000 groups. Now, it's a little bit of a contrived example, but still, the point is, we have a multiplication problem. For every combination, we need another group. For every subset, we need another group. This is a real issue. By allowing ANDs inside an ACE, we can reduce that, because you can simply say, if you're a member of this group and of that group, if you're a member of the engineering team and of Project Alpha, and you also happen to live in the Netherlands, or happen to be part of the Netherlands, then you have access. So the actual total number of groups that we need is drastically reduced. It's no longer a multiplication of the various subdivisions. It's now an addition. So in this example above, instead of having 500,000, you have, well, 610 groups, which is a massively better system to set up than we have today. Now, with Server 2012, we also get into the game of user claims. If we can actually define user claims, well, then things get even easier. Well, you have three type divisions. You have projects, you have countries, you have divisions, right? For each one of them, we have many values, and therefore many groups. But in reality, they're just one piece of data each, right? Which projects are you working on? Which countries are you part of? And which divisions are you a member of? Three user claims. That's all they are. We don't really need 610 groups. We need three user claims. And one access policy that says, if you and the file have the same project, country, and division, you have access. Instead of putting out 500 different ACLs across various machines in the organization, all you do is define one central access policy with the three groups, with the three claims, and you have the same setup. Now, sounds kind of magic, and how much did we have to break to make this all work? Well, nothing really. This is still just SDDL, right? The SDDL format is still the same. We still store the ACL in the same format, but we now include the conditional concepts in the SDDL. I actually just dumped this via iCACLs, right? This is what you actually see when you have a condition of department equals finance. Nothing really fancy behind it, but it's a simple extension to existing infrastructure. Question? Question is, can this be in any ACL or can it be on a file server only? That's a good question. No, this can theoretically be in any ACL. However, you do have the application or workload does have to support the evaluation of this. Now, the standard file check, SE access check, API, whatever it is, does support evaluation of these things. However, in Server 2012, the only workload to actively go and build the whole end-to-end scenario is the file server. Any other workload, any other application can evaluate in the same manner. If they use SE access check and provide the same information, including the ACL, they can do the same evaluation, yes. Let's talk about classification for a moment, because we're going to spend some time tying it in later. What's new? Classification is something that we introduced in 2008 R2, but we introduced it primarily for data management purposes. We specifically actually said, the classification infrastructure in 2802 is not intended to make security decisions. Well, it's because we had a whole bunch of, we had a few very specific limitations. One of the most important ones being, well, we store properties in 2802 in a way that anybody who has write permission to a file can modify. And if we use classification information for a of a file to make an access decision, we have to make sure that you can only modify that classification information if you're also allowed to change the security of the file. Else you could give yourself access to a file when you shouldn't. But let's talk about what's new. Manual classification is one of those... Oh, real quick. I'm not sure I understand the question. The central access policy. Oh, so the question is, can the central access policy conflict with the ACL on the file? Right? Okay, hold on to that question. We'll talk about that in a bit. All right, let's talk about what's new in classification real quick. So manual classification is one of those things that is incredibly common when it comes to any classification question, right? How do I classify files? Sure, there's automatic ways, but I need some way for my user to say, I just created a file. It is business impact critical. It is contains IP, right? I'm going to patent this in three weeks, right? Things like that. But manual classification 2802 wasn't really there. We had opportunities through Office. In Windows 8 and Server 2012, we now have a tab in the Explorer. Right-click properties on a file, and a tab shows up to classify your files manually. That tab, of course, doesn't show up on your home box because most home users will never care. In other words, this thing is actually protected by a group policy. If you issue a group policy, this tab will show up. On a file server, you can also install certain tools to make it show up as well. Additionally, we found that, well, classification properties that were defined on the individual machines was great in 2802, but we really needed a way to say, I, as an organization, I am basing security around an impact property or a compliancy property. So I need to be able to define it somewhere local, somewhere central, instead of locally machine by machine. So we defined classification properties or resource properties in Active Directory as of 2012. Those then get pushed out to file servers and Windows 8 clients, because Windows 8 clients are the primary vehicle in the end where a user wants to manually classify a file. They're not going to log into their server, into a file server to manually classify the file. They're going to use their clients and look at a remote share. So clients, at the same time, also need to see what the globally defined properties are in an organization. Classification is something that, automatic classification, is something that we've done quite a bit of in the last release. And, of course, we had inbox classification capabilities. We had third parties that were integrating with this, and this is all good. But one of the big things that we needed was we needed to make sure that it all happened fast. Automatic classification was a great thing, but in 2002, it was a scheduled process. It happened once a day, once a week, whenever it made sense. And what we would do is we'd go out and scan the server for files that needed to be classified, as in the classification needed to be updated, the file had been modified, things like that. But in reality, a lot of the classifications, especially when we talk about security, need to happen quickly. We need to know that this file has, you know, a credit card in it, or is impact equals high, or part of Project Alpha. We need to do that quickly. So what we do nowadays is we actually use the USN journal. We watch the files being modified and classify them shortly after they got modified. Additionally, we now store properties so that they can be used for security. We store properties that will be used for security as part of the security descriptor itself in the SACL. File management tasks, on the other side, something that we also had in the past. This was mainly around expiration of data and thing of management property, management like that. But we also said, well, if we know we have to classify files quickly, well, we also want to make sure that policies, management policies that need to be applied to files also happen quickly. So in just like with classification, if we see a file that matches requirements for a file management task, we also will apply that policy shortly afterwards. The other thing that keeps coming up is, well, I want to encrypt my files. Well, now we actually have that in the box. So we can say file shows up on server, gets classified, and gets RMS encrypted without extra intervention by a user shortly after the file is created. So let's actually see what this looks like. On the classification side. Oh, wrong mouse. All right, on the classification side, what we'll see here, and I realize big screen, little text. We will use Zoomit quite a bit, if I hit the right button, that is. So what we will be looking at is the File Server Resource Manager. This is where we expose all of our classification infrastructure pieces. Now here, what I've already selected is the Classification Properties tab on the left. And you see the classification properties are defined for this machine. Now, first thing I'll point out is that there's a scope column. The scope column tells us that out of those six properties, four of them are marked as global properties. That's because they were defined in Active Directory, and I'll show you how to do that in just a moment. Also, you'll note that those four properties are also marked as secure properties, although I think the wording changed in the release preview. Now, it is important to note that secure properties are ones we can base security around. Normal properties you cannot base security around. However, you can define properties locally. Locally, you can only define normal properties. Properties that will be used for security purposes must be defined in Active Directory. So, oh, wrong button, yeah, wrong mouse. So let's show you how that actually works. In Active Directory, I can go to Resource Properties, and we can see here a list of properties already defined. Out of these, three are enabled. The country property, the impact property, and the department property. We actually supply a good starting set of classification property definitions out of the box based on a lot of research we did for something called Data Classification Toolkit, where we came up with a useful set of classification taxonomy that is common to many organizations out there. We do not claim it is the perfect classification property set, nor even that it's correct at all. It is a good starting set. If it meets your needs as is, great. But if not, modify it, throw it out, use something else. This is all possible. Now, in this case, you'll note the country property up there is actually one that we've created here. Creating a property is relatively easy, actually. So what we do, new resource property, and we give it a name. We give it a name, and we pick a type. So let's go do that real quick. Let's call it secrecy. And we'll just pick a type. Now, the types are pretty straightforward. Nothing really complicated there. But we have a typed system here. These are all types that are a direct subset of what SharePoint supports. For some of these property types, such as single value choice and ordered list, we can define exactly which values may be put into the value of that property. Others, like integer or datetime, just restrict the type of a value, but not the exact values themselves. You note there's one extra thing there, and that is this checkbox right there. Is used for authorization. That is the question. If this button is checked, that property can be used for access control. If it's not checked, it cannot be used for access control. It can be used for other management purposes, but not access. Now, these properties are, of course, passed down, and now here we have a client. And the clients can go in and right-click properties on a file, and I can go to the classification tab. And you'll see exactly the properties that we defined. Country, department, impact. Right? Those are the properties that we defined in Active Directory in the end. So the client itself cannot define local property. Only the file server can. But it will show them in a manual classification experience. Question? Good question. Are resource properties really Active Directory attributes? The definition of a resource property is defined in Active Directory. The values for the individual files are not. The values are actually stored as what's called an alternate data stream for all properties. So they move along with the file as the file moves across machines, etc., as long as it stays in NTFS. And for properties that are marked as for authorization purposes, they are also stored as part of the SACL. The question is, do we need an extension to a schema? To define resource properties in IAD, yes, you need to extend the schema for that purpose, yes. Make sense? Now, But beware that generally classification properties don't change that often. Usually there's a process involved in deciding that we need a classification property in the first place, and there's not something that commonly changes. Now, once we've defined that, we can define a series of classification rules to deal with automatic classification, of course, as well. And we have here one that I showed earlier. I'll open it up again just really quick to, as it says here, mark files with credit card as high impact. No, it's small, but I read it for you just in case. And this one uses the content classifier, which extracts text from files using the same mechanism that the search indexer does, and then searches that text for existence of a string or pattern. In this case, it looks for a regular expression of 4 digits, that's 4 digits, that's 4 digits, etc. Now, one thing we changed, of course, is we kept hearing this. People really wanted to know when, you know, you have more than 5 credit cards in the file and mark those, say, as critical versus 1, which might just be a personal receipt for something that you had, right? So you want to be able to assign levels of importance. So we added the ability for classification rules using a content classifier to tell us how many occurrences do we have before we start flagging a file. Now, in this case, if a file matched that pattern, it then marked the file as impact equals high. Now, in the box, we actually have 3 classification plugins. Content classifier, the folder classifier, which does location-based classification, similar to what manually classifying a folder would do, and something new, the Windows PowerShell classifier. One of the basic things is always, what if you need something more advanced, something unusual? You want to classify files based on the owner of the file. You want to classify files based on the file type, or who knows what else. Well, the inbox ones generally don't really do that for you. But you could build a plugin. You could build a classification plugin that does that kind of logic. But most organizations don't want to really invest in a couple of developers to do that, to build a plugin for something. Well, we said, well, something most IT departments are willing to do is spend a little bit of time building a PowerShell script. So we can actually go to the PowerShell classifier now, go to configure, and you'll see there's a PowerShell script template where basically we have this cool function over there called get property value to apply. Whatever PowerShell functionality you put in there, the value it returns is the value that we assign to the file for the property. So whatever you can do in PowerShell, logic-wise, can now be used to assign a value to a classification property. Now, granted, there are some performance implications to doing that. It's a little bit slower to classify files, but this is easy. Now, classification is good, and we'll show file management task real quick as well. We have a RMS encryption task here, which basically says for files that meet this criteria, impact equals high, perform the following action. RMS encrypt them to high impact documents template. So as a result, what we can do, thanks to the real-time information, et cetera, oh, we already have one of these in here, but that's okay. Copy and choose the file to keep in the destination folder. I actually haven't tried that. We want to keep files from desktop. We want to keep both files. How's that? Let's see what happens. Hey, we get number 2. So I copied a file over, and this file, if I actually opened it beforehand, I should have done that earlier. We actually look, and we can see that there's a credit card number in there, or credit card number-like thing in there, matches our pattern. So what the file server now does is the USN journal spins up and sees a new write happening to the file system. We'll see that the USN journal entry saying new write was done, and we will see that file and classify it for us. Now, you'll see that, first of all, it moved up in the list, and we'll go classify that file. So if I click on classification now, you'll see it now is classified as impact equals high. If I reload this real quick, it also went from 13 to 146 kilobytes. You can tell I did this demo earlier. We RMS encrypted that file automatically without really having to do anything. So very simple to set up, doesn't take a lot of effort, and very powerful in and of itself. Now, let's take us back to our slide deck, which, of course, I stopped accidentally. Now, how does this all mesh with file access? Well, let's talk about file access in general first. In the past, file access was determined by 2 things. First of all, if you're remotely at least, we just looked at the share permissions. Will the share permissions let you through, yes or no, for what the file access you want? If so, will the NTFS permissions let you through? And then you had access or not. With central access policies, we add a third layer to that. We don't replace the existing. We don't supersede the existing. It's another layer of access that gets added. Now, what does that actually mean? How does that all look? Well, so when we do an access check, let's assume you're doing this remotely. The first thing we look at is, well, we look at the share security, right? The share security, share permissions and the share security descriptor. And we validate those. Then we look at the file or folder security descriptor. And you'll note inside the file or folder, we have two things. We have the NTFS permissions, the file permissions, and we evaluate those. And then we go and see that there is a reference to a central access policy available. That reference will then points to a record in Active Directory for a central access policy. We actually cache that central access policy locally on the file server, and we update that regularly. And if we verify that each rule inside of the central access policy allows us for access before we let somebody through. Now, let me flesh that out just a little bit for you guys. Given an Active Directory system, we have this Dynamic Access Control node in the Active Directory Administrator Center, and we have a few things here. And I'll focus on two things for now. We have the central access policies. Let's see if that's actually... Ooh, it does fit. Central access policies node, where we can define a series of central access policies. A central access policy is actually in of itself not much more other than a collection of central access rules, a named collection of central access rules. Now, what that basically means is each individual, think of it as as central access rules as a library of functions. A central access policy simply says, these are the pieces that I care about for this set of policy, versus another central access policy that says, these are the other set of rules that I care about for this policy. Now, in this case, we have a department file access rule and a high impact access rule. So let's open department first. Make that bigger so we can see more. Now, we see here, we have a name, department file access rule, and we have something called a target. And what that basically says in this case is this rule applies only to files which have a resource property, a classification property of department set. If there is no department property set in the file or folder, this rule does not apply. In that situation, if that does apply, then the specific rule here, let me expand this, is the user's department must be the resource department. They must overlap. Then somebody has access. You'll note also that there are the standard properties in there for system access, admin access, owner rights, and all that kind of thing, which does mean that if I've removed admin from that list, well, then that rule, if applicable, could block the admin from accessing the file. Admin can always gain it back through take own and all that good stuff, but basically it would block the admin from accessing the file. Let's take a look at the other one real quick, the high impact access rule. This one has a target resource of impact equals high. So if the file's impact property is high, then, well, we let people in as long as they're the owner of the file or an admin. Now, construction of these kind of conditions, it's very straightforward, and it's the same as what the advanced ACL editor, in the Explorer does as well. We can allow, basically, we select a principle, say, authorized, if I spelled that right, no, I did not, users, still didn't spell it right, excuse me, oh my God, why am I saying, you're right, thank you, authenticated users, authorized users, that's already done, right, and we don't have anything else left to do, authorized. All right, then we can basically add a series of conditions. And these conditions, we can basically create these conditions. It's always we pick user, device, resource. For a user, we can pick any of the user claims. Or we can say, are they a member of a group? So we can still make decisions based on their group membership. If we look at resources, we can look at the classification properties that are defined. So we can add conditions such as resource, dot department is any of users dot department. And we can, of course, create more conditions, another condition, and we can say, well, that's only true if the first two are anded together and the third one is ored. So we can make relatively complex expressions based on the information we have available. Now, if I create a series of central access rules, say I have a central access rule around HIPAA data and one around PCI, about credit card data, and one around personal information data, this is good. But the engineering department may not really care about all those. But what I can do is I can create a central access policy called engineering share access policy or engineering access policy. And we can say, well, for this access policy only contains the standard high impact central access rule and none of the others because they don't really apply there. What can then happen is we actually push out the central access policies to file servers by a group policy. So group policy can say these are the central access policies we care about for this OU or this machine. The file server admin, when he goes to share a folder, can then go to the advanced ACL editor and click on central policy and select which central access policy they want to apply to the share. Only the group policies that were pushed down to the server show up in this dropdown. So if you're going to somebody who generally only maintains engineering file servers or engineering shares but never finance shares, we don't even have to present them with the opportunity of assigning finance access policy. There's no reason for them to actually see that. It doesn't help anyone anything. It just makes people's work harder. Oh, keep using the wrong keyboard for... There we go. Now, from there, let's talk about how this thing actually works a bit more. So given a share, and let's say the file that we're trying to access, it has Department of Engineering and sensitivity of high. We also have share permissions. We have a central access rule for engineering documents, a second rule for sensitive data, and a third rule for sales documents, and last but not least, NTFS permissions. And you can see specifically which files the target, which targets the central access rules have, and which permissions the individual levels, so to say, would provide. So what happens, first of all, is, well, given that somebody accesses this file, the share permissions let everybody in. Everybody has full access. We're good. The central access rule then comes in and says, well, if your Department of Engineering, then you get modified. So for the engineering full-time employee and the engineering vendor, they both get modified permissions. But the sales FT should only get read. They don't value here, right? They're not right here. Sensitivity goes high. This is also part of the file, right? The file is a high sensitivity file. And it says all FTEs must have modified permission. But we have an engineering vendor. For engineering vendor, that rule would say, well, you have no permissions. You have no access permissions. For the other two, sure, modify is fine. The next rule has department sales as target. Well, we don't have a sales file. Therefore, this rule does not apply. Last but not least, the NTFS permission says, well, if you're FTE, you can modify, and if you're a vendor, you have read access. What does that mean now? Well, in the end, we actually look at the lowest level of access out of all of those to determine what level of access you have. For the engineering FTE, the lowest level of access they have is modify. For the engineering vendor, there was a sensitive data rule that said you have no access, therefore they have no access. The sales FTE, on the other hand, because of the engineering documents rule, only gets read access, even though they had full access for other reasons. We take the lowest common access. Question? So the question, a basic question is, are the central access policies next to the ACLs on the file system, or are they replacing them? They're actually sitting next to them. But because it's the lowest common denominator, it still allows you to limit things. So if you were to have a central access rule that says the admin has no rights, has no modify rights on these files, right? By default, they have no modify rights. Now, an admin on the file server can still go in and say, remove the central access policy from those files, right? Then they are no longer, it's no longer applicable. But they have to actually go do something. They can't accidentally go modify those files. They have to actually do that. And removing a central access policy is something that's logged by the security audit. Okay? Question? So the NTFS, the question is, NTFS, are they evaluated as usual, right? So if I have one group that gets read, another one gets write, and I, you know, you're a member of both, you get write, and then the other levels come in. Yes, effectively, right? We didn't change anything. If you look at an ACL in of itself, you still have the series of aces that are ORed together. It just happens that each ace could also be an expression, and we now have an additional level through the central access rules. Okay. So, well, now we get to a problem. You create the central access policy and push it out to all your file servers. What happens to your access? Who suddenly doesn't have access anymore that should have access and all those good kind of things? Okay, it could be a little bit complicated. Replicating the exact same environment everywhere that's for that we have in production in test just so we can try it out. It's a nice idea. It's been tried. It usually doesn't work so well because who wants to replicate all their machines? It just doesn't, right, and all their processes, and then you subset some users. It's just not worth it. So we need something better than that. Staging policies. This is a much better system from that point of view. So basic problem. So given we have Active Directory, we have a file server, we know a lot of information about them, we have everything set up correctly, and we create a central access policy as we've been talking about the whole time. Now, if I want to go in and change this, I want to go in, instead of just saying the user must be part of Contoso, what if I'm really thinking about, well, it should also be that maybe, you know, the user's clearance should be high. Well, I don't know what effect that's going to have, but I would like to create a staging policy that goes in parallel with the actual central access policy to see what will happen. So what we can do now is if we go back to our central access rules. Let's go look at, say, the department file access rule again. If I scroll down a bit more, you see here a section called proposed permissions. Now here, we can actually go in, enable permission staging configuration, and it copies all of the same ACEs that were actually in the currently in the central access rule. I can now go in and make changes. So I can go in here, for example, I know it's a little small, but you don't have to read necessarily. I can, for example, go in and create, extend my conditions, give someone else access, remove, make the access a level lower, and then push that policy out. Now, what I've done is I've updated the central access rule, but I have not made any changes in the actual access requirements. What I've done is I've said, I'd like to consider this option. What will then happen is, for every file access that's done, that gets we will evaluate the central access policy and let people in and out as before. But we will also evaluate the staging policy. If the staging policy access were to be different than what actually happened for the actual central access policy, we log an audit event. So in other words, if you got in, but you wouldn't have in the staging policy, we'll log an event saying you couldn't get in if this actually had happened. If you didn't get in now, but you would have gotten in, we'll let you know that as well. Now, what does it actually look like? We actually have a staging event, 4818, that shows us a lot of information about this. It tells us who was the person that tried to access this thing, what they were trying to access, what the current policy is that says you should have access to. And it also tells us here's how it would have been different based on the staging policy that was defined for this file. So we can then make a decision based on that information gathered from around our organization. Is this staging policy safe? Is this new policy safe for us to deploy? And if so, we can simply move it to be the central access policy and keep going. If on the other hand we find out, oh my God, everything's broken, all these applications that automatically put data somewhere no longer can, we simply remove the staging policy and nothing's ever changed. No one blocked things, no lost productivity, no lost money, but we have the information to be able to deploy this going forward. All right, we have half an hour left. We're going to talk about Kerberos. All right, so tokens. We actually extended Kerberos for this, right? We used Kerberos extensions for Windows 8 here. One of the basic things in Kerberos is, if you look in the past, we have user account information, we have user group information, and all the other good things that come in the Kerberos token anyway. In 2012, we've extended it to also include, in addition to the user groups, the user claims, the device groups, and the device claims. So they're all part of our Kerberos token that we supply as the client machine goes and talks to resources out there. So anybody that gets a token from us can take advantage of that information going forward. It's important to note that the device claims piece is extra. We effectively have a compound ID. Your ID is no longer just because you logged in, but it's because you logged in on this device. Now, basically, we've extended our own tokens to make all this happen, of course, but you will see that this has some interesting aspects to it. So how does this all work? First thing we'd have to do, well, the admin has to start saying, well, we need to start issuing claims, right? We need to define user claims or device claims. Once that's done, we define the actual claims in AD. When the user attempts to log in, they basically get a Kerberos ticket back listing their groups, their claims, etc. And when they go and access a resource, such as the file server, they provide that access token as an NT access token up to the file server. So how does that work with in the past? What happens, actually? How did all these changes happen? So before Windows Server 2012, a user will go and boot his machine. The DC will basically return a ticket-granting ticket for the machine. The user then logs in and gets the user TGT. This is pretty common for everything else that we'll see, so we're not going to repeat that specific area too much. Now when the user tries to access an actual resource, the user goes and requests a TGS. That will come back as not having any claims because he's talking to a pre-Windows 2012 DC. Only the 2012 DCs understand the concept of user claims. The schema defines claims, but the 2012 DC actually provides them. When the user then goes and talks to an old file server or even a new file server, it provides the TGS up without any claims available. Once we have user claims defined in Active Directory and therefore in a 2012 DC, when the user comes back and requests the TGS, it comes back and gets user claims right along with it and are then provided up to the file server. So it's pretty straightforward, nothing too complicated. What happens when I don't have a Windows 8 client? How does that work? The Windows 8 client doesn't know, first of all, to get user claims. What are those things? So what we actually do on the DC sets out a policy, sends out a policy by group policy to file servers, letting them know, here's a central access policy. When that central access policy gets sent out, and that central access policy contains user claims, a flag is set on the file server saying, you must make sure that user claims are available when making access decisions. So when the user then goes and tries to access a file and gets his TGS back without claims because he's not a Windows 8 user, this could be a Mac user, this could be anything, right? And presents that up to the file server without any claims because the file server knows I need to have user claims. The file server will go talk to the DC, the Windows 2012 DC, on the user's behalf via a process that we call S4U to self, and comes back with the TGS, including user claims. Then it uses that TGS to make an access decision. Okay? So we don't need to have a Windows 8 client to make this work. What we do need is a Windows 2012 file server to enforce the thing in the first place, and if you're using user claims, a Windows 8 in the 2012 DC. All right, compound identity. Let's just start talking about device claims. Things get a little more complicated, right? What actually happens is if we have device claims, when the user requests his TGS, he gets users and device groups. He gets user claims in addition to device groups and device claims back in the TGS. So he gets everything at once based on the device he's using, and then provides that up to the file server for access decisions. So it actually comes back that route. But forest boundaries, right? We have to do something here too. Well, what actually happens is if we have cross-forest trust, we can set up a transformation policy for claims. And so what we actually do is we publish this, the fact that we have a cross-forest transformation policy enabled. When the user then goes and requests access, he gets back a referral TGT instead. That referral TGT then gets passed to the other forest, the trusted forest, which returns back a TGS with the transform claims. That TGS can then be sent up to the other file server. To the cloud. What happens now? What are we providing these things to other applications out there? How does ADFS figure into this? Well, in a similar manner, we get TGS back. If we provide that to a random cloud app, it basically comes back and says, I don't know what to do with this. This means nothing to me. The TGS actually goes up to the ADFS, and the ADFS sends back a SAML token. That SAML token can then be passed up to the cloud with claims information included, so that information can be passed off to web services, et cetera, as well. Any questions? We'll have question time at the end, I'm sure of it too, but please. I don't know if it requires a new version of ADFS, to be honest. The question is, is there a new version of ADFS to go along with this? I'm not sure if it actually requires one. I don't think so. I believe that's right. Question? Yes? Good question. So, question going back to classification for a moment. We said we store classification information in the NTFS data stream, the alternate data stream. What if we have other software that also use the NTFS alternate data stream system? It works. Alternate data streams work on a concept that some streams are named, have known names, others are unnamed. But they can store multiple data streams per file. So commonly, for example, if you download a file off the internet with Internet Explorer, and you then attempt to open that file, it will tell you, this thing came from the file, from the internet. Are you sure? What actually happens is Internet Explorer creates an alternate data stream saying it came from the internet, which the system then goes and checks. This is commonly done by many pieces of applications out there, by antivirus scanners, all kinds of things. These things all work in parallel. Other question before I keep going? Token bloat. I know everybody wants to hear about token bloat. It's always interesting, always exciting. We're adding a bunch of information after all. So there's two pieces there, right? Token bloat, all the extra information we're adding into the NT token, and ticket bloat, right? We're adding a whole bunch of information also into the information that we send around the wire. So one of the basic problems that comes up, what kind of people in an organization have the biggest problem with token bloat? Anyone? What? Administrators. It's a good idea. Anybody else? Let's go on. Rotating people. Also a really good one. You know who else has really big problems with this? The leadership. The CEO, the VPs, those people. Because they have to have access to almost everything. And given the fact how groups work, you need a lot of groups to be able to do that. So this is a bit of an issue anyway. So what do we have problem here? We have Too many SIDs in the tokens, usually the problem. We have a fixed boundary after all. As time goes on and we add groups, we get more and more information that we have to store in this, we have more SIDs we have to store in the token, and it gets bigger and bigger. At some point, we get to a point that applications will suddenly stop recognizing your token because you have too much information in it. That's a problem. And usually it happens in the middle when somebody needs to do something and they suddenly no longer have access, when they really should have access. And oftentimes they have a lot of power to make sure they get access back now. And you get very angry phone calls suddenly, so that's bad. We don't like that. So what do we do? Well, we do provide, we do add extra information that goes over the wire. And we do expect that some ticket sizes will go up a bit, especially as people transition or maintain a lot of the existing group infrastructure that's already there. We're adding more information. This is just a given. We're going to add some extra information we have to pass over the wire. But what do we do to make this easier? Well, first of all, we start compressing a whole bunch of things that we don't compress today before we send them over the wire, so that what's there is a lot tighter in the first place. And this includes a number of SIDs that we didn't use to compress that we started compressing now as well. So the overall amount of data that we're transferring is still the same, but we compress it down to a smaller size to make things easier. The other thing we did is we increased max token size, the constant, to 48K by default. So that all the basic systems that use things, that use this constant, should just keep working and give us more room. Very importantly, though, we added a canary, so to say. An early warning system, right? We can now create an audit policy, effectively, that lets us know when we're approaching a specific ticket size, a specific token size. So that we can monitor this on various machines and know we're about to hit an issue here. Let's start thinking about it and let's start doing something ahead of time. All right, let's actually talk about what the real numbers look like for claims. All right, we did some analysis here, and we did extensive analysis. We found that adding a single Boolean claim, so single, yes, no, right, are you a full-time employee, yes, no, adds about 242 bytes. And we can see here, and these are bytes before any compression is done, so worst case scenario kind of thing. And we can also see here a little bit more underneath, we have an overhead for users, we have an overhead for devices. 120 bytes each, not too bad. But after that, we have some overhead. For each integer or bool, you get another 114 bytes. For the actual value, you need another 8 bytes. For strings, it's a little more complicated, right? You need 138 bytes just to have the string, but then you need 2 bytes per character. So if you have a bunch of claims with, 300 character long strings in it, they're going to add some data. There's not much you can do about that. Luckily, we can compress, so it's not as big of a deal as you think. But still. Now let's look at something a little bit more realistic. If you have a Boolean claim, an integer claim, a string with about 12 characters, that's not too bad, and another string with which could have multiple values in it. Say, another 12 characters and 6. Let's use 970 bytes. It's not that big, actually, and this is a very reasonable set of claims to have for a user, and this is without any compression. With compression, this can go down quite a bit. If you want to start talking compound ID, if you start adding 2 machine claims, it will add a little bit overhead again, and you'll see about, in this example, about 1374 bytes. But again, this is a worst case analysis. We shouldn't expect to see huge increases in token size. As people move from overly complicated group structures slowly into a world of expression-based access controls, user claims, device claims, we should actually see some of this shrinking somewhat. Well, maybe not zero, don't get me wrong, but we should see it shrinking. With the extra compression, we shouldn't see a lot of real-world impact switching over to claims in terms of token size. Now, I'll mention one more important thing, and that is deployment. How much stuff do I have to deploy to start using all of this? Well, it's not that much, actually. Given what you currently have, you don't have to replace anything. If you deploy a Windows 2012 file server, you can start using expression-based access policies on that file server. you can start classifying files on that file server. It will work just fine. To define user claims, to define central access policies, you need the schema update. You need to update the schema. If you want to use actual user claims in the end, you also need at least enough DCs to provide those user claims to people who log in. Right? You don't want one, you probably want two at least, right? One for hardware redundancy. But you need enough DCs for people to log in. You don't need to replace all of them. It's not required. If you do, that's nice. Don't get me wrong. I'm all for it. But you do not need to have functional level. Last but not least, if you have Windows 8 clients, then we get device claims. And we also get a much improved access denied assistance experience than what we had in the past. Question? What's the performance hits? Good question. So, in general, it's negligible. In general, it's negligible performance hits. Now, to be more correct, however, I can structure it, my central access policies, etc., in a way to have a performance hit. Right? If I create 1,000 conditions and they all have to be evaluated, you could make things slow if you really wanted to. In real-world deployments, we have not seen any substantial performance hits. Does that make sense? Good. All right. With that, summary. Reducing group complexity. Enable information governance on file servers. And implement effective access control. That's the goal of dynamic access control. And I hope I gave you a little bit of an idea of what this thing looks like internally. And I'm sure there's a whole bunch of stuff missing. And a whole bunch of stuff that's interesting. So please, feel free to ask. You have my complete attention for at least another 15 minutes. And I know there's dinner and beer calling, but hold on. Go ahead. Try to hear. The question is, I think, do I need to enable an RMS server or is it done automatically? Correct? Okay. So if you're using RMS encryption, you still need an RMS server. It still needs to be set up. We don't automate the RMS setup on the side. We use it if it is available in the organization. Okay? Questions? Please. So do we see any problems with a trusted domain that's not a 2012, does not have an updated schema? There shouldn't be any issues with that. That should be fine. If you require user claims, you have to make sure that those things are available effectively. But other than that, there shouldn't be any problems with that. You have to have the right functionality available, right? But other than that, no. If you have two forests, it must be forest trust. For translation purposes, yes. For the transformation purposes, yes. There must be some level of trust there available, yes. I think.
Is it also possible on a domain trust, or must it be?
Oh, a question is it also possible on domain trust, or must it be a forest trust? I believe domain trust would work as well. One more time, sorry. Correct. Yes.
If you access with NTFS token, you get the old access only.
If you access with NTFS token only, I believe the translation should still work. I think it should still work. It's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head, but I can gladly get the answer. Don't think anybody's from the AD team here today, right? Nope. Sad enough. See, this is what happens. I'm from the file server team. I don't know all the details. Not on the AD side, sadly, but most of them. Quick question. Yes, go ahead.
Another question on the AD side.
That's okay. I will do my best. I know enough, just sadly not that one.
So these central access policies and the building blocks, are they stored in domain context or forest context?
Okay. Are central access policies and the central access rules stored in domain context or forest context? Forest context. There's somebody over here. You're right. Yes. Do you need GPOs to activate it? So, to a point.
to get central access policies deployed to a file server. So if they're available there, you use a GPO. So there's a GPO for that. There is also a GPO to enable the classification tab in Explorer, and there's another couple of smaller GPOs along the way. For example, if you're using user claims on a file server for an expression-based ACL that does not have a central access policy, then there is a GPO you must set to make sure that the file server actually goes and requests user claims on the behalf of the user. So there are some GPOs in play here, and they are all listed in the deployment guides that we've published.
Can I just check, the Kerberos extensions
doesn't affect interop? Quick question is, do the Kerberos extensions affect interop? No, they do not affect interop. We provide them in a compliant manner, as far as I understand, yes. Ah, great question. Does it work with ACCESS-based enumeration? Yes, it does. Which is actually one of the great things. You have a file, you put it in the public share. I could show you that, actually. It gets classified as high impact, for example. People that look at a public share should not have access to high impact files, never even see that file. So yes, it works perfectly fine with that. Okay. So can you delegate creation of the rules to other admins, for example, right? So in Active Directory, we have standard security around the various components there. So you could delegate the AD pieces. The classification rules and file management tasks to encrypt files, those are on a machine-by-machine basis for the people of the local administrators group. Okay? Oh, good question. So basically, the basic question is, can we restrict people from accessing files when they're not in the corporate network, so connected remotely, et cetera? Theoretically, yes. Practically, it does require a partner solution because the concept of dynamic claims, not dynamic device claims, which is what this effectively is not something that we have in the box. We have all the pieces there, but the actual functionality of itself is not in the box itself. There are partners that are considering those areas, though. Good question. So we talked about central access policies being made available to via GPO to file servers. Why, question is, can't we force them on all shares somehow? So GPOs don't exist to force them. However, what we do have is we have something called the Data Classification Toolkit. It provides a whole bunch of tools that work with classification and various components. We've published it for 2008.02 for the file classification infrastructure, and we updated it for DAC for Server 2012. A beta of it is currently available. They also include some functionality to push out a default central access policy to a series of file servers. Oh, so when a file gets encrypted and gets sent out somewhere, when does it get decrypted? So RMS, in this case, that's what's integrated. Other third parties that encrypt files could get integrated as well through their own mechanisms. But RMS is the simple example. When the user opens the file, they usually use a smart client, Office, PDF extensions, et cetera, right? That client actually goes and requests a key from an RMS server. And it can do that via various pathways, including Microsoft account, et cetera. And that server makes an access decision of if the person should have access or not based on that template, RMS template, and provides the key back down. And then that application will decrypt it. Can you also say don't decrypt that file again? In general? Oh, to protect it from being sent over an email. You could most likely create a transport rule of some sort in your email system. But that's not something that's inherent to DAC itself. Mm-hmm. Okay. So So basically, if I take a hard drive with data on it that has a central access policy and all that good stuff, and I then take that hard drive and put it into a server 2008 R2 machine, what happens then? Is it now not accessible, et cetera? No, we actually, that SDDL chunk will effectively be a NOP, right? That will effectively have no effect on a 2008 machine. It will not, it will simply not provide any extra level protection. Question is, what are the next application services from Microsoft they're going to adopt enforcing central access policies? That's a great question. I don't have a great answer either way. Sorry, I just don't have an answer for you. I can tell you what's in Server 2012 and what's in Windows 8 client. I can't tell you beyond that because we don't know yet for sure, right? And the other applications out there, it's a great question to ask them. I can't speak to their plans, right? For what?
For Windows
7 or Vista to extend the token size. Oh, so will there be a hotfix for Windows 7 or Vista to extend the token size? I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I don't know the answer to that question. No, it's a perfectly good question. Please come get my card. I'm going to make sure you get your answer. I don't know off the top of my head. There are GPO settings for that. You're right about that. There are ways to do that, right, to force that out. But I don't know if there's something planned to make it easy for everybody just to default them back. I don't know if there's anything planned. I would not be surprised if the answer was we're not going to do anything other than give guidance of updating it manually, right, via GPO or something like it. That would make sense. Please. How does this work with DFS? Which DFS? Namespace or replication? Namespace. It works just fine. Has no effect. It works. It's completely transparent to that. Aha! Replication. Also a good question. So, replication. If you're replicating data between 2008 R2 or some other older system and 2012, there will be disagreement. When 2008 R2 is replicated over to 2012, it will overwrite the ACL information and back. So generally, we will say, for replication and DAC, replicate between 2012 and 2012, not between 2012 and 2008 R2. The other part that's important there is if you're going to be doing DAC, you're probably going to be classifying files of some sort. If you're automatically classifying files and you're replicating data, don't try to classify files on both sides of the replication. Not if they're writable, right? If it's a read-only, it's a whole other question. But if they're both writable, don't try to classify files on both sides. Because what will happen, effectively, is, well, one side will go, okay, I think this file is high impact, and I know the truth of this. And the other side will go and say, okay, file was modified. Ah, this file is high impact, and I know the truth of this. And the other side will go, oh, look, file was modified. And, you know, that's not good. We don't want that. So, classify on one side, both sides will agree, both sides will have the classification available, because the classification information will transfer just fine, but classify on one side. Okay? Please. Does it have any effect on access-based enumeration of DFS? If you don't have access to file, access-based enumeration will not let you see those files, etc. So, that's the main effect you have. Make sense? Does that answer your question? Yes. Yes, there's access-based enumeration for DFS specific namespaces specifically. It will still work with that. Yes. Please. Ooh. Okay, if we turn the cloud scenario around, could ADFS turn a XAML token into something that has claims effectively? I don't know the answer to that. What I'll do is I'll tell you this. Ask that question to Sam tomorrow in the what's new in AD in 2012. He should know the answer to that since he knows about ADFS very well. And actually, I would encourage you to go to that session anyway because you'll learn a lot of good things there anyway. Please. Do you need backup software that's compatible with this? If your backup software is compatible with ACLs in general and NTFS, especially if they use the virtual disk system and all those good things, it'll work just fine. You shouldn't need anything special. If you have a backup software that goes in and does its own processing of security and its own processing of files, then yes, they need to add support for that. In general, though, most backup systems tend to use snapshots in some form or another. That will just take care of it for you. More questions? We're out of time, but I'll answer them anyway. Please. Aha, okay. So given that you have a legacy client and a new file server, and the client goes and asks information, the file server goes and gets user claims for the user. Do we have to do some kind of delegation, trust kind of thing? No, the server uses the information provided by the client and requests it on behalf of the client. Does that make sense? Yeah. Please. Mm-hmm. So smart card. How does that work with smart card, right? Well, smart cards already work anyway, right, in 2008 R2. When you log in by smart card, you automatically show up as member of a special group. So that same thing works here as well, right? We can do a group member of. Any other questions? One more? Yes? So, oh, okay. So since we're storing all this information at the forest level, how much are we increasing the global catalog size? It's not that much, realistically. You're creating some definitions, but you're not creating crazy. You're not adding a lot of extra information here. It's not that much information you're actually adding. All right, guys, I think we're way over time at this point, or at least it seems like it. Just a little bit. We're okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.